Just remember, the things you see might not quite be your own reality. The dimensions exist within the inner, and then you know you're just a beginner. Because life just starts, and when it ends, turns around, and then it bends.
Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about consciousness and the evolution of consciousness and really who we are in terms of a bigger picture. And as we move into a future, as consciousness studies develop, as the science of consciousness evolves, we're discovering more of who we are and more of our potentials. And that's why I'm talking tonight to Julia Mossbridge, who is a researcher in consciousness. She's working with the Institute of Noetic Science in Petaluma. She's a scientist, and she has been studying consciousness for a long time, but in a really, I would say, a scientific way. Would you say that, Julia?
Yeah, my primary orientation is scientific, and then my secondary orientation is towards the transpersonal or transcendent.
Well, the science of consciousness is something I talked to Deepak Chopra about a lot, because it doesn't seem like there really is a science to consciousness in terms of the old science, you know? I mean, we need a science with new terminology, new ways of expressing things. And it doesn't seem like it can put consciousness into the old science. Would you agree?
No, because I think there's a misunderstanding about what the old science is.
Okay.
So I think the sort of our folk ideas, because of the there's a problem with science education in this country, in which people are taught, kids are taught that what science is knowing certain facts and understanding how they relate to each other. And that science is about physicalism, that everything that exists has to be in the physical universe and nothing outside the physical universe exists. But that's actually, neither of those things are true. But that's how people have begun to believe. That's how people have begun to characterize science. And therefore, anyone who has any kind of scientific ideas about consciousness that don't play by those rules is often told that they're being unscientific. Imats Barus and I just recently, last year, brought forward the book Transcendent Mind, Rethinking the Science of Consciousness for that very reason. It was published by the American Psychological Association and is essentially a textbook for people who are trying to reframe the science of consciousness.
Well, this is why your work is so important. But before we go any further, I want to say that Julia will be speaking in New York on October 30th.
That is super exciting. That's a conversation with Mitchell Rabin at the Ascension Church, which is, I believe, on the corner of 11th and 5th.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. You can go to abetterworld.net to find out the real specifics of that, the cost, admission, all that. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so I think I'm going to be doing the conversation with him and then signing books with my new book, The Premonition Code. So that's going to be very fun, I think.
Oh, yeah. I do want to talk about premonition on this interview. But cool. Also, you're going to be in Oregon because this program is also broadcast along the Oregon coast. So where are you going to be at?
Beaverton, just outside of Portland at Powell.
Powell Books.
Yeah, Powell Books. And that would be on the 15th of November. You can find out about that by going to thepremonitioncode.com/events. Also, we have Mitchell Rabin's event in New York on there as well. So multiple places to go to find the same information.
The Premonition Code dot, what was that?
Yeah, the name of the book is The Premonition Code. So the website is thepremonitioncode.com/events. And then I have all the events listed for the book tour.
Who published the book?
Watkins Media, and it's distributed in the U.S. through Penguin.
Great. Okay, let's get back to the science of consciousness and how it's been falsely identified. And then I'd love to talk about premonitions and the whole concept of science, consciousness, and time. So how do you define science? Because most scientists would say there's no framework to put the idea of consciousness. How do you
I don't believe that's true. I wouldn't say most scientists. I would say probably most physicists would say that. I think but most psychologists and most neuroscientists would say there has to be a framework for consciousness because we know it exists.
Well, but they say it's an aspect of the neurology, of the neurobiochemistry machine.
Some do.
And of course, you ask those people who do believe that, and they say, well, how do you, and this was an old question going back to, I think, T.H. Huxley, how do you get this awareness from the movement of chemicals within soft tissue? How do you get this awareness?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the hard problem of consciousness, framed most famously by David Chalmers, philosopher, who was instrumental in starting the Science of Consciousness meeting in Tucson, Arizona, among other things. I constantly, when I am being interviewed, I am often asked to support the idea that science just doesn't know anything about consciousness and we have to look elsewhere. And I just don't think that's true. I think that the problem is harder than just saying those people don't know what they're doing. In fact, there's plenty of really great neuroscientists and philosophers and psychologists, and now even artificial intelligence experts and roboticists who are thinking about consciousness necessarily because they need to understand consciousness to drive their science forward. And that's really the sweet spot, is when you get a scientist realizing we need to understand consciousness to understand our science. And some quantum people who study quantum mechanics are starting to recognize, oh, wow, we really need a framework for consciousness so we can understand what we're doing. So I think actually we're in a transition period where people are recognizing if we don't have a framework for consciousness, we literally can't make progress here. And that's going to cause a huge, I think, a decades of a bloom of research in this area. So I think we're just beginning, but I don't want to be discouraging to the people who are really working hard to shift the world of scientific research right now so it can encompass the idea of consciousness being something other than just an epiphenomenon of the brain. So
for right, instance, but I think to start, though, we have to define consciousness, because consciousness has now been used for everything as a substitute for God, the brain, the mind.
Yeah, yeah. There's multiple definitions.
Well, I want to define in the way that you define it and how you work with it in order to make a science of it. Yes.
Yeah. So I define consciousness the way the traditional. I think there are two uses of the word consciousness generally. There's actually four that have been indexed across thinkers, but probably more. But the two that I'm most interested in defining are, one, individual consciousness. So this is my personal experience of consciousness, which is like normally how neuroscientists talk about consciousness, which is when I'm awake or I'm dreaming, and I'm not in deep sleep, and I'm not under general anesthetic, my awareness or experience of having experiences, that is consciousness. So that's one form. And then there's another form that I'm also very interested in that is completely different and almost antithetical to the first, which is a non-personal consciousness, a sort of a unity consciousness, or what William James called the cosmic consciousness, where the roots of the trees would intermingle underneath the soil. To me, that is an essential piece of the understanding of what it means to be alive. And I think that is a very different kind of investigation than messing around with waking daily consciousness.
Well, let's talk about the first definition and maybe also how it interfaces with the brain and what's been called the mind, whatever that is. So, but you've defined it basically as awareness, I think, in that definition. Would you say that?
Yeah, it's like in a very simple sense, not in the sort of dramatic sense of, in the New Age sense of, are you awake? Are you aware of who you are? More in the very simple, I am aware that I'm talking with you right now. I'm aware that I'm sitting here right now. I'm aware that I'm, you know.
And that's an aspect of consciousness, that awareness.
I call it personal consciousness or subjective. I think the more formal term is subjective consciousness. I have this objective experience of consciousness, which is different from you looking at me and saying, or listening to me and saying, well, she sounds conscious. That's behavioral consciousness, which is someone else's sort of second or third person opinion that someone else is conscious. But subjective consciousness is the big bugaboo, because we have to try to figure out how it relates to the brain, right?
Right. So let's go to that first hard question of science. You know, we have an awareness, like, you know, I'm talking, you're talking. How does those chemicals, that neurology, translate into knowing? I mean, these are such vague concepts, but everyone knows who.
So, I mean, your question is underscoring the bias, which is that so that the brain creates personal consciousness, that the brain creates subjective consciousness rather than, for instance, subjective consciousness creating the brain, or right. rather than them both being created by some third thing.
But isn't this traditional science? I mean, if we're talking about science, that the brain does create something.
Yeah, traditionally, we're laughing because the light went off in Alan's room.
Right, it has an automatic timer.
Maybe you weren't dancing around enough. You should get more excited and dance around.
I'm very excited about this because this is really the only thing worth talking about and understanding.
I think so too. But yeah, no, scientifically, traditionally, in the last century, there's been a bias towards materialism, which says that subjective consciousness arises from the material world. So we better try to figure out that created the hard problem. How does it arise from the material world? And then there's this whole group of scientists who said, well, it's an epiphenomenon. So it's emergent from the material world. The material world gets so complex that consciousness just emerges. And then there's a bunch of people that say, well, that seems bogus.
Well, you know, Freud said consciousness emerged as a survival mechanism. That goes back to those early post-Darwinian, and Freud was part of that.
Right. And he wasn't thinking, I don't think, as in a materialist sense as much. But in any case,
that's the hard science. Okay, so let's go address that. Yes.
Well, so let's go address that. The reason that ever happened is because it is clear that there is a relationship between the brain and personal consciousness or subjective consciousness. If you've ever known anyone who had a stroke or anyone who had any kind of neurological disorder, it's very clear. You can see, oh, there's a problem here in the brain, and oh, they can't remember their words. I mean, so there's no question that subjective consciousness, that you could stimulate the brain and have people smell things, you could stimulate the brain and have people have a deja vu experience. There's just no question that the brain and consciousness are related. So whatever theory you have about the relationship between brain and consciousness, it has to include this relationship. It has to include that they are related. But in terms of directionality, that's really, a lot more neuroscientists are starting to recognize that that's really an open question. And they're starting to call, you know, the science of consciousness meeting is starting to call, I think they actually generated this idea of calling the experiences that are related to consciousness, the neural correlates of consciousness. I mean, I'm sorry, the neural circuitry that seems to underlie conscious experience, according to the traditional scientific view, they've been calling the neural correlates of consciousness. So you don't have to presuppose any kind of directionality. They're correlates. They're not necessarily.
When you say directionality, what do you mean? What does that mean?
Not causal. What I mean is causal directionality. So to say something is correlated, like these, you know, the neural correlates of vision are in the occipital lobe, right? Or visual cortex. That's a nice term because it says that the neuron firing is in the visual cortex is correlated with subjective experience of vision, right? But it's not saying these neuron firings are causing visual experience, and it's not saying visual experience is causing these neural firings. It's just saying there's a correlation, and I think that's the most agnostic, that's the most correct point of view, because we don't either side of this argument about who causes what, or you know, whether consciousness causes the brain or the brain causes consciousness. There's arguments for either side.
But to make it simple, could we use the analogy of the radio? The radio receives a signal and then puts out a sound. The brain receives, as a receiver, picks up whatever this consciousness is.
Yes, I love.
Is that not true?
Well, no, we don't know. So what I'm trying to say is that everyone likes that who is invested in the idea of consciousness not being caused necessarily by the brain. It's nice to have the radio analogy. I love that analogy, and I've been thinking about it for years, like many people, right? What I'm saying is I would like to be intellectually honest and say there's evidence for that analogy, and there's evidence for that, frankly, if I stimulate the brain, you're having an experience. Now, you could use a radio analogy to, you know, you could say like, sure, and if I inject current into this particular wire in the radio, it gets louder, right?
Right,
so
exactly.
The analogy still works, but then the question that has to be solved. So I guess I'm about like, okay, fine. It's all good. those are all good ideas. Now, how do we test where the signal's coming from? How do we have a theory, let's say it's like a radio, about the signal that the, what does that signal mean to the brain? I mean, to me, wanting to, I guess I want to warn against this idea of wanting to decide too early how things work just because we desire to be right. And I think it's really valid to question the way, I mean, I think it's obviously a little book about
can
it.
Can we ever be right? I mean, science, if it's real science, is about
being wrong all the time. Yes.
Yeah. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the way.
It's an educated guess, though. I mean, the value of science that it keeps looking and expanding its understanding.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we need that because we're intelligent beings trying to understand the way it all works.
Right, right. I mean, for sure, I'm pro using science to try to understand consciousness. Wrote a whole book about it. But what I'm saying is what I'm encountering in the world of intelligent, educated people who are curious about these things is people wanting to know an answer right now. And I think that's because of the way our educational system teaches science, is it's about, oh, here's the answer, here's the answer, here's the answer, instead of leading people through the discovery process and helping them understand how shaky any of those answers really are and how they themselves can have intuitions about really good questions and really good ways to respond to those questions. So I'm kind of trying to respond on a deeper level of, sure, the radio analogy seems really good. It's a filter analogy. Aldous Huxley talked about it. Many people talk about it. There's good evidence that, like, for instance, from psychedelic studies, that it might be, in fact, really accurate. But there's a lot. I'm already on to the, how does that work? Tell me how that works. Tell me how, let's figure out where the signal tower is. And I have an idea about it. And honestly, this brings us to the premonition code stuff, because I think the signal tower is in our own futures. I think that consciousness is almost emitted from our future self.
Our future, you're saying?
Our future self. I mean, so this is a radical idea, but I have the hypothesis. Okay. Yeah, I figured.
That's why I call the show New Realities, because I want radical ideas. Be as radical as you can be, please.
Okay, great. So here it is. My sense, and this is a hypothesis, this is not even as strong as a theory, it's a hypothesis, that our conscious experience is actually, we are receiving it from our future selves. That consciousness is essentially, if we're looking for the signal tower, it's us, but in the future.
But then we have to talk about time, because who are we anyway, and do we really exist within a time frame when you talk about us or me or you? I don't think we live in a time, so maybe it's the future, or maybe it's all happening.
So when I say, sorry, just to clarify, when I say future, what I mean is the colloquial. So I agree, there's not a lot of evidence that we're living in space-time, and there's a lot of evidence that our perceptual system likes to set up this space-time thing. So when I say future, what I mean is the thing that we call our future selves in this space-time story.
So premonitions come from the future awareness that is that, but I guess
not just premonitions. So I think my hypothesis is informed. Most of my research has been on time and on how we perceive time and how we have conscious awareness of future events. So it's informed by that. But I think premonitions or precognitions are telling us something larger, which is that actually it all comes from our future self.
I was just wondering, do you believe in timelines there for, like, okay, I have a premonition, I could go this way or that way, and then a new time future self is moved?
I see. So you're talking about sort of like a many worlds idea of a branching of possibilities?
Well, premonitions do happen sometimes, and sometimes they don't, you know? So,
I guess I stick to the more scientific definition of a precognition, which is the more scientific term, which is actually something that accurately. So in other words, I wouldn't call a dream precognitive if I dream that my father died and then my dad's alive for the next year. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say that's a precognitive dream unless I dream that he dies in a very unique way, and then a year later he does die in exactly that way. Okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. But so the point is, I guess we need to separate sort of the folk experience of, oh, I feel like this is going to happen, which could easily just be paranoia or anxiety, or it could be a true precognitive experience, from something that, that scientifically we've tested in the lab, and it's clear that people can have a precognition in a way that's replicable in the laboratory. So I'm saying, given that that is the case, that we're clearly getting information from our future selves via precognition, as shown by laboratory experiments, I'm wondering if it's just special information or if it's all information.
Well, I would say it's all information. I would also say you don't need to just, it's just my comment, relate it to just the time-based understanding of consciousness, because when you do remote viewing, and I've learned it from the Stanford research people who developed that.
I wasn't in it.
I learned it from those guys when I
actually
interviewed Russell Targ. He said, oh, it's this simple, and here it is, and this is what you do, and boom, I got it.
Yes.
So it's time and space-based. So, I mean, consciousness is, as Deepak Chopra says, non-local. I mean, lots of people say that. So premonition is just one little avenue of that aspect of the all-wise knowing intelligence.
Well, that's right. And as people get better at precognition, they tend to get better at telepathy. So, I mean, that's across space. So it seems to me, there's no difference. Precognition is the easier thing to talk to people about in a lay audience, because more people have had precognitive dreams than almost any other type of parapsychological experience. So to me, it's all the same. And this is just a way in.
I mean, then would you say consciousness is the all-wise knowing intelligence of all time, all space, and that?
Are you talking about cosmic? Yeah, the cosmic consciousness?
Yeah.
To me, it's another word for God, essentially. It's like what the generations have called this thing that moves in us and through us and beyond us, and that both creates and destroys us, and that weaves us together as one. That seems to be what people are referring to.
So what's the relationship between your two definitions, the personal and the cosmic? I mean, where's the boundary line and what is that?
I think it's really interesting that in English we call these the same word, because I think this is fascinating, because many, many mystics would say that what we're calling consciousness, our waking daily experience, is like unconsciousness from the point of view of cosmic consciousness. In other words, our waking daily individual experience is kind of like the story beyond which we have to get. And so I think it's fascinating that in English we call them the same thing. I think there's a lot of privileging this idea of awareness as if being aware of something. I think it's because in the West we really, really crave understanding and control. And so it's this idea that if we can just understand our individual consciousness, then we could become one with this cosmic consciousness. And I think that's pretty ridiculous, partly because obviously we're already one with it. It's the cosmic consciousness. And two, this little individual consciousness is basically, as far as I can tell, equivalent to what we call the ego. And I think the ego wants to say, oh, if you just, you know, if I could just be conscious of everything, then I could be part of that big thing. And I just think it's actually more like, yeah, if you could let go of the idea that you matter at all and that you have any control at all, then you have much more opportunity to become more aware of your connection to this big thing.
But maybe it's also what Jill Bolte Taylor said in her TED Talk. I'm sure you've seen that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Where when you're the left brain, you are the individual ego personality. Of course, she lost that left brain. She became the total cosmic awareness. So maybe that is the balance of the human psyche.
That's a hypothesis many people have. And I think it's an interesting hypothesis. Not everyone who has the same kind of stroke that she had has the same experience. So I think she was keyed up for that experience. I think that's a way to think about it in a simple term.
So back to you and your consciousness, but your research is okay, because I think, you know, these terms are so vague and they're like morphing all the time based on a kind of collective understanding, I think.
Sure. Because
where does your work fit in? What are you doing?
So half of my mind says it doesn't really matter where my work fits in, and the other half wants to tell me what I'm doing.
I want to know what you're doing.
You want to know? Okay.
I do.
So I have been fascinated since I was a kid with the disconnect between what I was being told was the order of events and the available information about the future and what I experienced, because I had many, many precognitive dreams that I started writing down in a journal. And I started recognizing these correspondences that were I mean, I had a physicist father and a therapist mother and then another therapist mother, and they were all very scientifically minded, but I had my notebook so I could check to make sure I wasn't making things up, but they were too detailed correspondences to believe the story about that time is working in this way where you don't get to know about the future and the past is gone. And I had too many dream experiences that showed me different ways of thinking. And so when I say too many, I mean too many to just stay on the narrow path. So I strayed from the narrow path. And so I you know, went to highfalutin schools and got awards and stuff. But what was important is when I claimed my truth about what I wanted to study. And that was actually after I got my PhD. And I had studied a lot of things about time, a lot of time perception and how the brain works and such. But what I really wanted to understand was these bigger questions about what is the relationship between this sort of folk wisdom idea about time that I know is incorrect and what's going on in the natural world. What is the structure and the nature of time? And how does that, and later, I started realizing that I had an additional question, is how does that relate to love? Because my sense is that there's a very close connection between understanding, and not even understanding, that's the wrong word, experiencing time as it really is and unconditional love. I think that they're almost equivalent, which may sound weird, but that's my experience. So anyway, that's my work.
We'll start there at the first part, and then we'll get to love, if you don't mind. So what did you discover? Because I totally agree with you. There's something that our traditional understanding of time and sequences, yet we have deja vus and psychic insights and dreams. Yeah. I just had a dream the other day that, oh my God, it happened. I dreamt of these swans, and which, who would dream of that? I never would. But then I went to this art show at the Guggenheim, and it was full of these pictures of swans, and now I'm writing about that. So
yep.
I don't know.
It could be coincidence, but also...
Or no, I don't think it.
So experiments with precognitive people who dream precognitively on a regular basis, especially two sets of experiments that I think are very impressive with Stanley Krippner and Montague Ullman's, among others, studies at the Maimonides Center in New York, very impressively show that independent judges can match dream content, precognitive dream content, with random targets when they don't know which target was associated with the dream. And that was replicated in a beautiful second study. So precognitive dreams. And then there's also, I mean, if we want to classify precognitive experiences, which I think we should, because people have a lot of questions about this. Another one is the waking precognition, very frank. Like I was watching a movie the other day, and in the movie, this woman, Colette, that new movie out, this woman, she's hugging a dog, and then I think, well, yeah, but I think she really likes the turtle better. And I'm thinking, why do I think that? I've never read the book, but anyway, later in the movie she gets friendly with this turtle, and I think, so that was interesting. So those kind of, I mean, that's a simple one, and it's not, and it could be a coincidence. It's not a very compelling one, but
I get it. I get it. You get a premonition. You get a feeling.
It's an example of one of these sort of light ones. Then there's heavier ones that can, you just download a lot of information about something and then it happens. Those are the ones that I think, if we can make precognition not taboo and make it part of the regular culture and train people to use controlled precognition, which is essentially a subset of remote viewing, if we can do that, then what that means is the world benefits in a huge way for two reasons. One is that I had a precognitive dream that was very accurate and showed me the date and the location, but not unfortunately not the correct location, but the location and the events when there was a bombing in a mosque during noontime prayers. So I saw the noontime prayers, I saw the bombing, and I saw the date actually flash in the dream. And then the location was incorrect. In the dream, it was Kyuk Kyuk, which is not a location. And in reality, it was Kuwait City, Kuwait. So it just had the first letter. So in any case, what if multiple people in around that same time had similar dreams, and some people got the place but not the date, and some people got the date but not the place, and some people just got the event, and we had a way to get that information and cull out the bad information and act on the good information, we could actually change the future of this planet. So I'm very committed to technologizing precognition.
How would we know? Who would be in the position? Because I'm sure a lot of people have dreams that just aren't their fabrications, or they're not premonitions, or they may think they are. So who would to judge that?
Yeah, so most dreams aren't precognitions. Most waking experiences of thinking of future events are just anxiety. It's sorting out the events from, so that's actually why I created the website, thepremonitioncode.com, because it has a training. It's called a positive precog training area. It has a free training to help screen and both two things. One, to screen for people who have the skill, and it uses a scientific means to do that. You can't really get around the method. You're trying to predict a future photo, and either you predict it or don't. And also, so it's screening, but it's also encouraging people to practice and to learn this skill, because let's say we have a group of people who are particularly good at this, then those would be good people. If they have a dream like this, they have a higher chance of it being accurate. But then at the same time, you could technologize this, right? You can run machine learning on people's responses. You have millions of people around the world participating. You can decide who over time seems to be most accurate. And then in certain situations, you can see so-and-so is really great at terrorist strikes, but not very great at earthquakes. So I'm only going to use their dreams about terrorist strikes, right? So if we put our minds to it and put our technology to it, I think this will be a hugely beneficial platform to help augment artificial intelligence predictions that are already happening about future events.
But yeah, but going back to my original question about the old science, I just want to know I believe it's true, but I don't know what explains the premise. Yes, maybe we're us in the future, but how would you bring that down to physical science, or maybe you can bring it into the physical science realm?
You could try. So, I mean, part of studying precognition is, at least for me, is to try to understand mechanism. So one way to do that is to start doing physics experiments. So I'm starting doing physics experiments with photons that are in the future and understanding how they affect photons that are in the present. But another way to do it is to try to, by doing that, you start to develop hypotheses about what's going on, and then you can try to block transmission, right? I mean, you all think
how
of it
do
as
you
a,
block transmission?
I don't know, because it depends on the results of experiments. I mean, so like we're in the middle of discovery. So once we figure, once we make discoveries around what are the underlying factors, like I have a bunch of results that seem to suggest that reproductive hormones have an influence on precognitive ability. Once we understand the underlying factors, we can start to get better hypotheses about how it's this and not that. So it's just, we're in the middle of it.
So, okay, but you're developing a science, which I think is really great, and heading towards a new way of understanding it all. So what kind of theories are you formulating for the world to embrace as we move into this kind of awakened?
Everything's really speculative. I'll tell you about my speculations. I won't use the word theory because that sounds a little bit more advanced than I think anyone is at this point. So my speculations, so one is, speaking of hormones, so if you think of precognition, and I'm going to define that scientifically right now, as getting accurate information about a future event that cannot be obtained by inference or direct cause. So that means, if it's raining outside and you think to bring your umbrella, that is inference, that's not precognition. If you really like petting dogs and there's a dog and you pet the dog, and the night before you dreamed about petting a dog, that's not precognition, right? So that would be direct cause. So anyway, so in terms of precognition defined in that way, if you think of it as a mirror in time, so like remote viewing, you're trying to predict a future event. When we have memory, we're trying to recount an event that happened in the past. So those two things are like mirrors in time. If you show a photograph to someone, they'll remember some things, they won't remember some things. If someone's trying to predict what a photograph they'll be shown, they'll be attracted to some things and not other things. So that's like a mirror in time. If you think of precognition as a mirror in time, it's different from the mechanism that underlies it should, if you think of it's an evolutionarily adaptive skill, which clearly it would be, the mechanism that underlies it would have to be something that actually is a lazy response mechanism. And
what
the reason,
that?
What I mean is, like, the brain is a really quick response mechanism, you know, takes tens of milliseconds to see something and hundreds of milliseconds to understand what it is, and then maybe a couple hundred other more milliseconds to respond, right? So it's a very fast responding mechanism. Let's take another physiological system. The skin conductance. So the amount of sweat when you start to feel nervous and then you start to sweat, that's a much slower response. It can take seconds for that thing to respond and to say, whoa, okay, I'm in a situation, I'm standing in front of a room, getting a talk, oh, now I'm sweating. That's a slower responding system. The reason I'm saying that you would want like a lazier or slower responding system is if it's slower going in the forward direction, you would think it would be slower going in the backward direction, and you could get a signal earlier in time. So think about something, it's like if you think about really viscous, like honey, it takes a while when you take a spoon out of the honey and it sort of slowly starts to leave the jar. That's the kind of system you want when you're trying to have if you imagine an event having an impact in both directions in time, you want it to have a long impact back in time so you have the earliest possible detection. And that's why I'm fascinated by these results that suggest that hormones, which by the way are another slow acting system, hormones may be involved in precognitive ability.
Well, what also reminds me of, like, is a whole theory of culture I've been writing about and developing, how different modes of arts seem to move together, like the way jazz and cubism and even quantum physics, even though it's not an art, sort of an art of interpretation, they all kind of parallel each other. Let's say that in the early 1900s, and then you get that movement towards, even in politics, you get that movement towards fascism in the 30s, and that's worldwide. So there's, and then in the 60s, you get another wave of creativity in the arts and music and culture all around. So there's these waves of time flows that I think that are conforming our cultures to the creative process. So I mean, in a sense, it goes along with that. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that's really cool to think about. I think the creative process is really, when you talk about the creative process, I think that arises from the same place that we're talking about precognition or getting the information. To me, it's all from the future. It's all communicating. If you look at some of Philip K. Dick's stories, how prescient they were about future technologies and events, and that's true of almost every artist. They're coming from the same space. In fact, there's scientific evidence that people who are more creative have more creative output, especially in the performing arts, but also in the visual arts, seem to do better on parapsychological tasks. So,
there's that great quote by Terence McKenna who says, if the artist can't find the way to the future cannot be found, you know?
Yeah, right. It's almost like right. So thinking along these lines, it's almost like the work of the artist is to create that trace into the future and to select one of these timelines. I'd like that.
Well, I call it making known the unknown. I think the value of art is to bring the unknown awareness into the known consciousness of the culture.
Cool.
And so this is a cultural evolution, although, and you're talking about personal and I guess collective, as we value premonition as a real means of dialoguing with our future selves, and we get another level of society.
I think we do. I think it's one like many practices that can, I think of it as a martial art that allows people to knock down the walls between them in time and also in space.
Can you get better at it if it's an art? I mean, what can you do to practice it?
Yeah, so to practice it, so there's various arguments about whether you can get better at it, but I think what's clear is that if you read Joe McMonagle's books about remote viewing, which the subset of remote viewing that he normally practices is what I call controlled precognition. In other words, no one in the room knows what the target is while you're doing the viewing. So you're precognizing the future. Hopefully no one on the planet knows what the target is, because that would be legitimate controlled precognition from my point of view.
Right, as opposed to someone knowing it, and then are you reading their mind, or are you actually getting the signal from the target? Yes.
Exactly. And so he talks about going through, he says natural talent is a big piece of it, and I agree. And you can go through these stages where you start to filter out a lot more of the crap from your analyzing mind that likes to tell lots of stories. It doesn't mean you ever get perfect at it, but I do think people get better at that. I teach actually a course in controlled precognition with a great teacher, John Vivanco. He and I do it together online. And so if someone wanted to do that, of course they could do that. You can find out about that at thepremonitioncode.com. But also, you could also just go to that website and train yourself in controlled precognition for free. And to me, it's a process of human discovery. I mean, I love it. It's a process of discovering the relationship between the personal or subjective consciousness and this cosmic consciousness. So to me, it's a pretty rockin' experience. And we've got something like 644 people now, and they're working towards being in the Hall of Fame, and which is really
what
hard.
What Hall of Fame is that?
Well, we have a Hall of Fame on the website for anyone who has gotten to the point where they've done enough of these trials to be scientifically, statistically significant as a precog.
Oh, so the website, again, I'll write this down, is what?
It's thepremonitioncode.com. Okay. And then there's a subset of it called the positive precog training area. And that's where the juice is for, there's a classroom, there's information about, also the events page is really great because it has information about the controlled precognition training.
But the classroom's also free. You could train yourself for free on that website, right?
100%.
Wow. But let's also talk about that subject you mentioned, love.
Yeah, let's talk about love. Yeah,
let's talk about that. How is it related to love, precognition?
It's like here's this. There's unconditional love seems to be coming from a non-dualistic place. Because conditional love is about dualism. So it seems that unconditional love comes from this non-dualistic place. If you're in a non-dualistic place, space and time are problematic. They don't seem to exist there. It seems that that non-dualistic place would necessarily be without space and time. So to me, unconditional love is like another expression of saying, I am connected with the timeless, spaceless place. Or I am connected with the timeless, spaceless time. Or I'm connected with the timeless, spaceless space-time, right?
And when you're in that love space, but you are in that timeless place.
Yeah, so when I teach controlled precognition, controlled precognition came from remote viewing, which was a military-taught sort of martial art. But I teach it with a lot of unconditional love, and teaching people to, when they're done with each session, regardless of whether they got it correct or not, to go back in time, to essentially try to put themselves back in time and just send love to the self that was working on the project so that they could continue their practice and they don't have to feel the shame that we tend to associate with being wrong or, you know, in school, not succeeding.
Well, there's lots of therapies like that where you send love to your I guess, inner child, if you
want. Right. I'm writing a whole book about those kind of time travel therapies. But I think it's really important to recognize that that same place is the same place that brings the information. It's the same place that brings creativity. It's the same place that brings anything that's of value.
So I get, I think we all have that space. It's like the internal space inside of us. That's if we find that.
And connecting with it is really the key. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
So, no. I'm just, what do they call rapping with you? So essentially though, based on everything you said, who we are as consciousness, in a sense, doesn't need a brain, or we exist beyond the body in that sense, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, so that brain is a spaceful, timeful thing. It only exists for a certain period of time, and it goes places. So, I think, in terms of the evidence, I think there's, in my mind, there's no doubt that there's scientific evidence that consciousness is something, that our personal consciousness is something that seems to interact with something that is way larger than our brains.
But does that, is there, would you say there's a soul that then continues and incarnates, like maybe the Eastern traditions say?
Yeah, I got to be honest, I don't know much about the reincarnation literature. I do know some of the basic, like Ian Stevenson's work, some of the basic results. But I have to say that I find it too focused on the personal consciousness, like the I. I think it's very biased by this desire to not die and desire not to lose the ego. And I honestly, if I were creating the universe, I would create it so there wasn't reincarnation, so people wouldn't have this idea that there's some kind of eternal thing in the I. I don't think the I is eternal. Cosmic consciousness is eternal.
No, but if we have that consciousness, isn't that the I? Isn't that really the I?
So we got to remember there's those two definitions. The first one is the I, or builds the I. Awareness builds the I. I wouldn't say it's equivalent to the I. And the second one is the one that I think is eternal, cosmic consciousness.
But is that localized for right now within me and you and whoever else is out there?
Is which number one or number
it's
two?
It's the cosmic consciousness, which transcends the personal ego, still seems localized.
I think that's a lie. I think that's just because we want it to be in the world of duality, because we can't stand it. Our ego cannot stand to not be involved.
So when the individual ego then dissolves back into the ocean with just the ocean, is that
Yeah. I just have this idea that we all go into the soup, and then maybe something that was your ego goes in as a potato that goes into someone else's mouth later, but it's not your ego anymore.
But there is awareness without ego that still is then being perceived by something that not necessarily is ego, or is it all ego when we talk about the my perception? That's what I'm asking.
I don't know if there's a like an answer to that, but my opinion is it's all ego. So my opinion is that when you talk about my perception, you're wanting to be special because you're you.
No, but when we talk about dropping into that place of cosmic consciousness, there's still an awareness that perceives the cosmic consciousness.
I don't think that. I think that's the cosmic consciousness is awareness playing as if it is your ego to make you feel comfortable. I think that when in my meditation practice, my experience, and in my dream practice, my experience is that there's a lot of fabrication going on to make you feel comfortable with discovery. And that fabrication has to do with making your ego feel okay, like it's not going to dissolve. And so I think there's a lot of work that goes into that.
But when your ego dissolves, there seems to be an awareness that's aware of the dissolution.
Yeah, and I think that's awareness comes from the cosmic consciousness and will be still there after you die. That awareness is not in you.
But the awareness is being recorded by a mechanism that seems to be us, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be aware of it.
Well, I don't know. That's a rule that you're posing.
I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying that.
No, I know. I'm playing with you. What I'm saying is that if you want to pose that rule that something is recorded by the thing that it seems to be recorded by, you're going to be wrong in lots of cases, right? Okay. So it may seem to us that it's coming from us because we experience it, but that's kind of like saying the ocean is coming from my finger because I put my finger into the ocean.
Mm-hmm. All right. But I'm just trying to understand those moments when we all have had a cosmic awareness that transcends the ego. What is it that has the awareness of that?
The cosmic awareness. It's no longer the ego. The ego wants it to be that it's it, but in order to transcend the ego doesn't get to play. And so it is literally the cosmic awareness being aware of us.
And that then it's reflected as if it's me.
Our story about it after we're done is I had this experience.
But when we're having
the experience, it certainly doesn't feel, at least for me, it does not feel like I am having an experience. It feels like an experience as having me.
Okay. I don't know how much we can't go into that direction that much more, okay, because right. But I do want to talk about your work a little more and your science and the experiments that you're doing and sure. how you're bringing it to the public in a scientific way.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about some of the experiments you're doing?
Sure. Let's see. We don't have much time left, so I'm trying to think on my feet about what would be most interesting to talk about. But I guess the ones that I think are most interesting, one is I'm working with a really, really amazing hypnotherapist, Adam Crabtree in Toronto, who is the hypnotherapist for Esalen. And he has been working with myself and Marcia Neeson, who's a research assistant, to try to see if we can hypnotize people to be more unconditionally loving, and if we do, if they get better at precognition, and to hypnotize that same group of people, but at a different time, to be better at precognition, and to find out if they get better at being unconditionally loving. So, in other words, we're trying to see if there's crossover between these two. And
that's
exciting. Yeah, that's exciting. Well, we just finished the experiment, so I have to analyze the data.
What do you suspect? I mean, if you want to.
Well, of course, my hypothesis is that it'll cross-pollinate, right? But I haven't looked at the data, so I have no idea what the actual reality is. One of the great things about doing science is you get an answer and you're usually wrong. So.
Well, it does go along with Eastern philosophy. The more unconditional and loving, the more presence and awareness, maybe it was even Jesus who said, what's here is everywhere and what's not here is nowhere, Yeah. So there's this expansion of mind when you expand it into the pure love state.
Yeah.
And the Buddha field, whatever. So I think that hypothesis sounds right, but I'm curious.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll see. And then another study that I'm doing right now, I'm analyzing a bunch of data from the PsyQ app, PSIQ, which actually it's going to change its name soon to PSI3. But anyway, it's an iPhone app where you can for free test your precognition and your psychokinetic abilities. And I helped build that. And so I'm analyzing that data set with thousands of people participating. And so far, I'm finding some interesting gender differences, which are along the same lines that I've found in the past, gender differences that seem to relate to reproductive hormones. So I'm excited about that. And
but let me also ask you, though, what was the – I didn't mean to cut you off. Sorry. I was.
No. I could go on forever. You do need to cut me off.
No. But I just wanted to know what really excited you about the whole premonition idea. I mean, what was that first peek into a bigger window that said, oh, my God, there is something going on here that's called or feels like premonition?
Well, I mean, my very first precognitive experience was a dream when I was 7. And I dreamt that a friend of mine lost her watch on the playground. And I dreamt that it happened during recess. And the next day, that same friend lost her watch during recess on the playground. And I thought, wow, that's way too many coincidences and not predictable, right? I mean, a lot of kids had watches. Some of them were my friends. But why that dream? So that made me start thinking. But that's sort of a story I tell about why I became interested. But honestly, What I believe the more honest answer is that my future self has told me that this is what I'll be doing, and I'm following the instructions. Mm. So it's like when we use the word calling to describe something, this is my calling. This is my calling, and I feel like it's a literal calling through time from my future self.
Does the future self emerge out of the cosmic self? I mean, how do you qualify or quantify the future self in terms of the personal versus the cosmic?
I don't know, but I love that idea. When you said, does the future self emerge from the cosmic? I love when I get a picture right when someone says something, because that makes me think that there's really something there. I had this image of sort of the amorphous cosmic self. Or cosmic consciousness and sort of a splitting off of a new shape in the future and then coming to meet you in the present. And I'd love that way of thinking about what the control tower for consciousness could really be.
Well, yeah, that sounds like a great little visual, because I'm just thinking in terms of ego and future self, because in a sense there is an ego, but there isn't an ego in the future self. And the way that we would become aware is to transcend an ego-based individual understanding of here, now, and kind of surrender that to a cosmic self that was in touch with everything as it gets filtered into a future ego self. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's what you're saying is the ego is carrying from the past forward, and the future self is going from the future to present, and they're meeting in the middle. And in order to be aware of that carrying, the self from the future, the ego needs to stop claiming it's the only thing that matters. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, not claim. I wouldn't say that. The claim, not claiming the only thing, but that it exists within the cosmic. I'm just trying to go back to the argument.
Oh, right. That it exists within the claim that it exists right. in the cosmic.
That's what I was going for. But yeah, but I don't know. I'm just throwing these ideas out. I mean, who
knows? Well, no one knows. They're completely untestable ideas as of now. But they're, you know, it's interesting to think about it. Sometimes you get a feeling of a truth of something, and there's a ring of truth, and then you follow that. So it's an amorphous blob.
Well, no, but the important thing is that there is such a thing as precognitive awareness.
It
absolutely exists, and everyone has maybe a touch of it or a glimpse of it. And
people have more of it than they realize. It's usually unconscious, yes.
And we can use it, though. Sometimes it's beneficial. You know, we don't want to go down that road, or we, you know, there's certain feelings I think we should listen to in terms of that.
Yeah, and a great if you're interested in a great book to read about that in more detail, besides The Premonition Code, one is called, it's Jim Carpenter's book, First Sight, and he talks about how everyone is using precognition all the time, and it's really the first piece of information about the future, and that's calling us forward. I think I'm really influenced by Jim's work.
What's his name again, Jim what?
Jim Carpenter. He's a psychoanalyst who has noticed so many psychic ties with patients and started studying this stuff, has done a really good job. So,
well, I guess synchronicity kind of comes into play as well, you know, when everything just lines up and boom, it's like everything is just in sync. So it's like the future and past and present all merge into this oneness.
Juicy oneness. Yes, exactly.
But I really do appreciate your research, and I think it's really important. And we have to keep thinking about this, because once we break out of that old mold of the physical science, anything is possible. And then the value of who we are as human beings just expands.
Agree. Yes, I agree. Thank you.
So you'll be in New York on
October 30th, the day before Halloween, which is a Tuesday night, 7 p.m., I believe, at the Ascension Church on 11th and 5th with Mitchell Rabin in a conversation and then a book signing afterwards.
Great. And you'll also be at Powell's Books in Portland, Beaverton on November 15th. This is all 2018 for those.
That's right.
To the archives. And your future, where's that going? I mean, as far as your work, what do you see? What's your premonition for yourself?
I really, really love teaching people how to get in touch with their future selves. So I think that'll be a big piece of my future. And I really love writing. I'm working on this book about essentially time travel therapies. And I really love performing. I'm interested in creating a TV series where people could learn about these things in a responsible way. That's not this sort of titillating way that these things have been portrayed so far, as like titillating and somehow creepy through paranormal shows.
Right.
I'd like to switch that around.
Right. Because it's normal. There's nothing
exactly
paranormal.
Yeah. It's normal, and it just needs to be normalized and used, and building applications to do that.
Thank you, Julia. Julia Mossman. The Premonition Code is the book, and the premonitioncode.com, you said, is the website?
Yep. You got it.
I appreciate this. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Thanks. Me too. I really appreciate your great questions and your cool ideas.
Well, I think about this. So when I meet someone who's also thought about this, there's all these moments that converge, and it's like,
it's pretty nice.
Yeah, so I appreciate meeting a fellow traveler on the road to the future.
Me too.
But I'll probably see you in New York too. So
yeah, that's probably true.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com, and my YouTube channel, youtube.com/newrealities.